Dewey fired, and again, and again. Neither man fell, though each had been shot through the heart 3 times. They simply rather slowly turned transparent, by degrees grew invisible, evaporated, though the loud laughter expanded until Dewey bowed before it, ran from it, filled with a despair so mournfully intense that it awakened him. When he awoke, it was as though he were a feverish, frightened 10-year-old. His hair was wet, his shirt cold, damp, and clinging. The room, a room in the sheriff's office, into which he'd locked himself before falling asleep at a desk, was dull with near darkness. Listening, he could hear Mrs. Richardson's telephone ringing in the adjacent office, but she was not there to answer it. The office was closed. On his way out, he walked past the ringing phone with determined indifference, and then hesitated. It might be Marie, calling to ask if he was still working and should she wait dinner. "Mr. A.A. Dewey, please. Kansas City calling." "This is Mr. Dewey." "Go ahead, Kansas City. Your party is on the line." "Al?" "Brother Nye." "Yes, brother." "Get ready for some very big news."
"I'm ready."
"Our friends are here. Right here in Kansas City."
"How do you know?"
"Well, they aren't exactly keeping it a secret. Hickok's written checks from one side of town to the other, using his own name."
"His own name? That must mean he doesn't plan to hang around long. Either that or he's feeling awful damn sure of himself. So Smith's still with him?"
"Oh, they're together okay. But driving a different car. A 1956 Chevy. Black and white 2-door job."
"Kansas tags?"
"Kansas tags. And listen, Al, are we lucky? They bought a television set, see? Hickok gave the salesman a check. Just as they were driving off, the guy had the sense to write down the license number, jotted on the back of the check. Johnson County License 16212.
"Checked the registration?"
"Guess what?"
"It's a stolen car."
"Undoubtedly. But the tags were definitely lifted. Our friends took them off a wrecked DeSoto in a KC garage."
"Know when?"
"Yesterday morning. The boss, Logan Sanford, sent out an alert with the new license number and a description of the car."
"How about the Hickok farm?"
"If they're still in the area, it seems to me sooner or later they'll go there." "Don't worry. We're watching it." "Al?"
"I'm here."
"That's what I want for Christmas. All I want. To wrap this up. Wrap it up and sleep till New Year's. Wouldn't that be one hell of a present?"
"Well, I hope you get it."
"Well, I hope we both do."
Afterward, as he crossed the darkening courthouse square, pensively scuffing through dry mounds of unraked leaves, Dewey wondered at his lack of elation. Why, when he now knew that the suspects were not forever lost in Alaska or Mexico or Timbuktu, when the next second an arrest might be made, why was it he felt none of the excitement he ought to feel? The dream was at fault, for the treadmill mood of it had lingered, making him question Nye's assertions, in a sense disbelieve them. He did not believe that Hickok and Smith would be caught in Kansas City. They were invulnerable. In Miami Beach, 335 Ocean Drive is the address of the Somerset Hotel, a small, square building painted more or less white, with many lavender touches, among them a lavender sign that reads, "Vacancy, lowest rates, beach facilities, always a sea breeze." It is one of a row of little stucco and cement hotels lining a white, melancholy street. In December 1959, the Somerset's beach facilities consisted of 2 beach umbrellas stuck in a strip of sand at the rear of the hotel. One umbrella, pink, had written upon it, "We serve Valentine ice cream." At noon on Christmas Day, a quartet of women lay under and around it, a transistor radio serenading them. The second umbrella, blue and bearing the command tan with copper tone, sheltered Dick and Perry, who for 5 days had been living at the Somerset in a double room renting for $18 weekly. Perry said, "You never wished me a Merry Christmas." "Merry Christmas, honey. And a Happy New Year." Dick wore bathing trunks, but Perry, as in Acapulco, refused to expose his injured legs. He feared the sight might offend other beachgoers, and therefore sat fully clothed, wearing even socks and shoes. Still, he was comparatively content, and when Dick stood up and started performing exercises, headstands, meant to impress the ladies beneath the pink umbrella, he occupied himself with the Miami Herald. Presently, he came across an inner page story that won his entire attention. It concerned murder, the slaying of a Florida family, a Mr. and Mrs. Clifford Walker, their 4-year-old son, and their 2-year-old daughter. Each of the victims, though not bound or gagged, had been shot through the head with a .22 weapon. The crime, clueless and apparently motiveless, had taken place Saturday night, December 19th, at the Walker home, on a cattle-raising ranch not far from Tallahassee. Perry interrupted Dick's athletics to read the story aloud and said, "Where were we last Saturday night?" "Tallahassee? I'm asking you." Dick concentrated. On Thursday night, taking turns at the wheel, they had driven out of Kansas and through Missouri into Arkansas and over the Ozarks, up to Louisiana, where a burned-out generator stopped them early Friday morning. A second-hand replacement, bought in Shreveport, cost $22.50. That night, they'd slept parked by the side of the road somewhere near the Alabama-Florida border. The next day's journey, an unhurried affair, had included several touristic diversions. Visits to an alligator farm and a rattlesnake ranch, a ride in a glass-bottomed boat over a silvery, clear swamp lake, a late and long and costly broiled lobster lunch at a roadside seafood restaurant. Delightful day. But both were exhausted when they arrived at Tallahassee and decided to spend the night there. "Yes, Tallahassee," Dick said. "Amazing." Perry glanced through the article again. "Know what I wouldn't be surprised? If this wasn't done by a lunatic. Some nut that read about what happened out in Kansas." Dick, because he didn't care to hear Perry get going on that subject, shrugged and grinned and trotted down to the ocean's edge, where he ambled a while over the surf-drenched sand, here and there stooping to collect a seashell. As a boy, he'd so envied the son of a neighbor who had gone to the Gulf Coast on holiday and returned with a box full of shells, so hated him, that he'd stolen the shells and one by one crushed them with a hammer. Envy was constantly with him. The enemy was anyone who was someone he wanted to be or who had anything he wanted to have. For instance, the man he had seen by the pool at the Fontainebleau. Miles away, shrouded in a summery veil of heat haze and sea sparkle, he could see the towers of the pale, expensive hotels. The Fontainebleau, the Eden Rock, the Roney Plaza. On their second day in Miami, he had suggested to Perry that they invade these pleasure domes. "Maybe pick up a couple of rich women," he had said. Perry had been most reluctant. He felt people would stare at them because of their khaki trousers and t-shirts. Actually, their tour of the Fontainebleau's gaudy premises went unnoticed, amid the men striding about in Bermuda shorts of candy-striped raw silk, and the women wearing bathing suits and mink stoles simultaneously. The trespassers had loitered in the lobby, strolled in the garden, lounged by the swimming pool. It was there that Dick saw the man, who was his own age, 28 or 30. He could have been a gambler or a lawyer or maybe a gangster from Chicago. Whatever he was, he looked as though he knew the glories of money and power. A blonde who resembled Marilyn Monroe was kneading him with suntan oil, and his lazy, beringed hand reached for a tumbler of iced orange juice. All that belonged to him, Dick, but he would never have it. Why should that son of a bitch have everything while he had nothing? Why should that big-shot bastard have all the luck? With a knife in his hand, he, Dick, had power. Big shot bastards like that had better be careful, or he might open them up and let a little of their luck spill on the floor. But Dick's day was ruined. The beautiful blonde rubbing on the suntan oil had ruined it. He'd said to Perry, "Let's pull the hell out of here." Now a young girl, probably 12, was drawing figures in the sand, carving out big, crude faces with a piece of driftwood. Dick, pretending to admire her art, offered the shells he had gathered. "They make good eyes," he said. The child accepted the gift, whereupon Dick smiled and winked at her. He was sorry he felt as he did about her, for his sexual interest in female children was a failing of which he was sincerely ashamed. A secret he'd not confessed to anyone and hoped no one suspected, though he was aware that Perry had reason to, because other people might not think it normal. That, to be sure, was something he was certain he was. A normal. Seducing pubescent girls, as he had done 8 or 9 times in the last several years, did not disprove it. For if the truth were known, most real men had the same desires he had. He took the child's hand and said, "You're my baby girl. My little sweetheart." But she objected. Her hand, held by his, twitched like a fish on a hook, and he recognized the astounded expression in her eyes from earlier incidents in his career. He let go, laughed lightly, and said, "Just a game." "Don't you like games?" Perry, still reclining under the blue umbrella, had observed the scene and realized Dick's purpose at once, and despised him for it. He had no respect for people who can't control themselves sexually, especially when the lack of control involved what he called pervertiness, bothering kids, queer stuff, rape. And he thought he had made his views obvious to Dick. Indeed, hadn't they almost had a fist fight when quite recently he had prevented Dick from raping a terrified young girl? However, he wouldn't care to repeat that particular test of strength. He was relieved when he saw the child walk away from Dick. Christmas carols were in the air. They issued from the radio of the four women and mixed strangely with Miami's sunshine and the cries of the querulous, never thoroughly silent seagulls. "O come, let us adore him. O come, let us adore him." A cathedral choir. An exalted music that moved Perry to tears, which refused to stop, even after the music did. And as was not uncommon when he was thus afflicted, he dwelt upon a possibility that had for him tremendous fascination. Suicide. As a child, he had often thought of killing himself, but those were sentimental reveries born of a wish to punish his father and mother and other enemies. From young manhood onward, however, the prospect of ending his life had more and more lost its fantastic quality. That, he must remember, was Jimmy's solution, and Fern's too. And lately it had come to seem not just an alternative, but the specific death awaiting him. Anyway, he couldn't see that he had a lot to live for. Hot islands and buried gold, diving deep in fire-blue seas towards sunken treasure. Such dreams were gone. Gone, too, was Perry O'Parsons, the name invented for the singing sensation of stage and screen that he'd half-seriously hoped someday to be. Perry O'Parsons had died without having ever lived. What was there to look forward to? He and Dick were running a race without a finish line. That was how it struck him. And now, after not quite a week in Miami, the long ride was to resume. Dick, who had worked one day at the ABC Auto Service Company for 65 cents an hour, had told him, "Miami's worse than Mexico. 65 cents. Not me. I'm white." So tomorrow, with only $27 left of the money raised in Kansas City, they were heading west again. To Texas. To Nevada. Nowhere definite. Dick, who had waded into the surf, returned. He fell, wet and breathless, face down on the sticky sand. "How was the water?" "Wonderful." The The closeness of Christmas to Nancy Clutter's birthday, which was right after New Year's, had always created problems for her boyfriend, Bobby Rupp. It had strained his imagination to think of two suitable gifts in such quick succession. But each year, with money made working summers on his father's sugar beet farm, he had done the best he could, and on Christmas morning he had always hurried to the Clutter house, carrying a package that his sisters had helped him wrap and that he hoped would surprise Nancy and delight her. Last year he had given her a small heart-shaped gold locket. This year, as four-handed as ever, he'd been wavering between the imported perfumes on sale at Norris Drugs and a pair of riding boots. But then Nancy had died. On Christmas morning, instead of racing off to River Valley Farm, he remained at home. And later in the day, he shared with his family the splendid dinner his mother had been a week preparing. Everybody, his parents and every one of his seven brothers and sisters, had treated him gently since the tragedy. All the same, at mealtimes he was told again and again that he must please eat. No one comprehended that really he was ill, that grief had made him so, that grief had drawn a circle around him he could not escape from and others could not enter, except possibly Sue. Until Nancy's death, he had not appreciated Sue, never felt altogether comfortable with her. She was too different, took seriously things that even girls ought not to take very seriously, paintings, poems, the music she played on the piano. And, of course, he was jealous of her. Her position in Nancy's esteem, though of another order, had been at least equal to his. But that was why she was able to understand his loss. Without Sue, without her almost constant presence, how could he have withstood such an avalanche of shocks? The crime itself, his interviews with Mr. Dewey, the pathetic irony of being for a while the principal suspect. Then, after about a month, the friendship waned. Bobby went less frequently to sit in the Kidwells' tiny, cozy parlor, and when he did go, Sue seemed not as welcoming. The trouble was that they were forcing each other to mourn and remember what, in fact, they wanted to forget. Sometimes Bobby could. When he was playing basketball or driving his car over country roads at 80 miles an hour, or when, as part of a self-imposed athletic program, his ambition was to be a high school gymnastics instructor, he took long-distance jog trots across flat yellow fields. And now, after helping clear the dining table of all its holiday dishes, that was what he decided to do. Put on a sweatshirt and go for a run. The weather was remarkable. Even for western Kansas, renowned for the longevity of its Indian summers, the current sample seemed far-fetched. Dry air, bold sun, azure sky. Optimistic ranchers were predicting an open winter, a season so bland that cattle could graze during the whole of it. Such winters are rare, but Bobby could remember one. The year he had started to court Nancy. They were both 12. And after school, he used to carry her book satchel the mile separating the Holcomb schoolhouse from her father's farm ranch. Often, if the day was warm and sun-kindled, they stopped along the way and sat by the river, a snaky, slow-moving, brown piece of the Arkansas. Once Nancy had said to him, "One summer, when we were in Colorado, I saw where the Arkansas begins. The exact place. You wouldn't believe it, though. That it was our river. It's not the same color, but pure as drinking water, and fast, and full of rocks, whirlpools. Daddy caught a trout." It had stayed with Bobby, her memory of the river's source, and since her death. Well, he couldn't explain it, but whenever he looked at the Arkansas, it was for an instant transformed. And what he saw was not a muddy stream meandering across the Kansas plains, but what Nancy had described. A Colorado torrent, a chilly, crystal trout river speeding down a mountain valley. That was how Nancy had been. Like young water. Energetic. Joyous. Usually, though, western Kansas winters are imprisoning, and usually frost on the fields and razory winds have altered the climate before Christmas. Some years back, snow had fallen on Christmas Eve and continued falling, and when Bobby set out the next morning for the Clutter property, a 3-mile walk, he had had to fight through deep drifts. It was worth it, for though he was numbed and scarlet, the welcome he got thawed him thoroughly. Nancy was amazed and proud, and her mother, often so timid and distant, had hugged and kissed him, insisting that he wrap up in a quilt and sit close to the parlor fire. While the women worked in the kitchen, he and Kenyon and Mr. Clutter had sat around the fire cracking walnuts and pecans, and Mr. Clutter said he was reminded of another Christmas when he was Kenyon's age. There were 7 of us. Mother, my father, the 2 girls, and us 3 boys. We lived on a farm a good ways from town. For that reason, it was the custom to do our Christmas buying in a bunch. Make the trip once and do it all together. The year I'm thinking of, the morning we were supposed to go, the snow was high as today. Higher, and still coming down. Flakes like saucers. Looked like we were in for a snowbound Christmas with no presents under the tree. Mother and the girls were heartbroken. Then I had an idea. He would saddle their huskiest plow horse, ride into town, and shop for everybody. The family agreed. All of them gave him their Christmas savings and a list of the things they wished him to buy. 4 yards of calico, a football, a pincushion, shotgun shells, an assortment of orders that took until nightfall to fill. Heading homeward, the purchases secure inside a tarpaulin sack, he was grateful that his father had forced him to carry a lantern, and glad, too, that the horse's harness was strung with bells, for both their jaunty racket and the careening light of the kerosene lantern were a comfort to him. The ride in, that was easy, a piece of cake. But now the road was gone, and every landmark. Earth and air. All was snow. The horse, up to his haunches in it, slipped sidewise. I dropped our lamp. We were lost in the night. It was just a question of time before we fell asleep and froze. Yes, I was afraid. But I prayed. And I felt God's presence. Dogs howled. He followed the noise until he saw the windows of a neighboring farmhouse. I ought to have stopped there. But I thought of the family. Imagined my mother in tears. Dad and the boys getting up a search party, and I pushed on. So naturally I wasn't too happy when finally I reached home and found the house dark. Doors locked. Found everybody had gone to bed and plain forgot me. None of them could understand why I was so put out. Dad said, "We were sure you'd stay the night in town." Good grief, boy. Who'd have thought you hadn't better sense than to start home in a perfect blizzard? The cider tart odor of spoiling apples. Apple trees and pear trees, peach and cherry. Mr. Clutter's orchard, the treasured assembly of fruit trees he had planted. Bobby, running mindlessly, had not meant to come here, or to any other part of River Valley Farm. It was inexplicable, and he turned to leave, but he turned again and wandered toward the house, white and solid and spacious. He had always been impressed by it, and pleased to think that his girlfriend lived there. But now that it was deprived of the late owner's dedicated attention, the first threads of decay's cobweb were being spun. A gravel rake lay rusting in the driveway. The lawn was parched and shabby. That fateful Sunday, when the sheriff summoned ambulances to remove the murdered family, the ambulances had driven across the grass straight to the front door, and the tire tracks were still visible. The hired man's house was empty, too. He had found new quarters for his family nearer Holcomb. To no one's surprise, for nowadays, though the weather was glittering, the Clutter place seemed shadowed and hushed and motionless. But as Bobby passed a storage barn and beyond that a livestock corral, he heard a horse's tail swish. It was Nancy's babe, The obedient old dappled mare with flaxen mane and dark purple eyes like magnificent pansy blossoms. Clutching her mane, Bobby rubbed his cheek along Babe's neck. Something Nancy used to do. And Babe whinnied. Last Sunday, the last time he had visited the Kidwells, Sue's mother had mentioned Babe. Mrs. Kidwell, a fanciful woman, had been standing at a window watching dusk tint the outdoors, the sprawling prairie. And out of the blue she had said, "Susan, you know what I keep seeing? Nancy. On Babe. Coming this way." Perry noticed them first. Hitchhikers. A boy and an old man, both carrying homemade knapsacks, and despite the blowy weather, a gritty and bitter Texas wind, wearing only overalls and a thin denim shirt. "Let's give them a lift," Perry said. Dick was reluctant. He had no objection to assisting hitchhikers, provided they looked as if they could pay their way, at least chip in a couple of gallons of gas. But Perry, little old big-hearted Perry, was always pestering Dick to pick up the damnedest, sorriest-looking people. Finally, Dick agreed and stopped the car. The boy, a stocky, sharp-eyed, talkative towhead of about 12, was exuberantly grateful, but the old man, whose face was seamed and yellow, feebly crawled into the back seat and slumped there silently. The boy said, "We sure do appreciate this." Johnny was ready to drop. "We ain't had a ride since Galveston." Perry and Dick had left that port city an hour earlier, having spent a morning there applying at various shipping offices for jobs as able-bodied seamen. One company offered them immediate work on a tanker bound for Brazil, and indeed, the two would now have been at sea if their prospective employer had not discovered that neither man possessed union papers or a passport. Strangely, Dick's disappointment exceeded Perry's. "Brazil. That's where they're building a whole new capital city. Right from scratch. Imagine getting in on the ground floor of something like that. Any fool could make a fortune." "Where you headed?" Perry asked the boy. "Sweetwater." "Where's Sweetwater?" "Well, it's along in this direction somewhere. It's somewhere in Texas. Johnny here, he's my gramp. And he's got a sister lives in Sweetwater. At least I sure Jesus hope she does. We thought she lived in Jasper, Texas. But when we got to Jasper, folks told us her and her people moved to Galveston. But she wasn't in Galveston. Lady there said she was gone to Sweetwater. I sure Jesus hope we find her." "Johnny," he said, rubbing the old man's hands as if to thaw them. "You hear me, Johnny? We're riding in a nice, warm Chevrolet. 56 model." The old man coughed, rolled his head slightly, opened and closed his eyes, and coughed again. Dick said, "Hey, listen. What's wrong with him?" "It's the change," the boy said. "And the walking. We've been walking since before Christmas. Seems to me we covered the better part of Texas." In the most matter-of-fact voice, and while continuing to massage the old man's hands, the boy told them that up to the start of the present journey, he and his grandfather and an aunt had lived alone on a farm near Shreveport, Louisiana. Not long ago, the aunt had died. "Johnny's been poorly about a year, and Auntie had all the work to do, with only me to help. We were chopping firewood, chopping up a stump. Right in the middle of it, Auntie said she was wore out. Ever seen a horse just lay down and never get up? I have. And that's like what Auntie did." A few days before Christmas, the man from whom the grandfather rented the farm turned us off the place, the boy continued. "That's how come we started out for Texas. Looking to find Mrs. Jackson. I never seen her, but she's Johnny's own blood sister. And somebody's got to take us in. Leastways him. He can't go a lot more. Last night it rained on us." The car stopped. Perry asked Dick why he had stopped it. "That man's very sick," Dick said. "Well, what do you want to do?"
put him out? Use your head. Just for once. You really are a mean bastard. Suppose he dies. The boy said, he won't die. We've got this far. He'll wait now. Dick persisted. Suppose he dies. Think of what could happen. The questions. Frankly, I don't give a damn. You want to put them out? Then by all means. Perry looked at the invalid, still somnolent, dazed, deaf, and he looked at the boy, who returned his gaze calmly, not begging, not asking for anything. And Perry remembered himself at that age, his own wanderings with an old man. Go ahead. Put them out. But I'll be getting out, too. Okay, okay, okay. Only don't forget, said Dick. It's your damn fault. Dick shifted gears. Suddenly, as the car began to move again, the boy hollered, hold it! Hopping out, he hurried along the edge of the road, stopped, stooped, picked up 1, 2, 3, 4 empty Coca-Cola bottles, ran back and hopped in, happy and grinning. There's plenty of money in bottles, he said to Dick. Why, mister, if you was to drive kind of slow, I guarantee you we can pick us up a big piece of change. That's what me and Johnny been eating off. Refund money. Dick was amused, but he was also interested, and when next the boy commanded him to halt, he at once obeyed. The commands came so frequently that it took them an hour to travel 5 miles, but it was worth it. The kid had an honest-to-God genius for spotting, amid the roadside rocks and grassy rubble, and the brown glow of thrown-away beer bottles, the emerald daubs that had once held 7-Up and Canada Dry. Perry soon developed his own personal gift for spying out bottles. At first, he merely indicated to the boy the whereabouts of his finds. He thought it too undignified to scurry about collecting them himself. It was all pretty silly, just kid stuff. Nevertheless, the game generated a treasure hunt excitement, and presently he, too, succumbed to the fun, the fervor of this quest for refundable empties. Dick, too, but Dick was in dead earnest. Screwy as it seemed, maybe this was a way to make some money, or at any rate a few bucks. Lord knows he and Perry could use them. Their combined finances amounted at the moment to less than $5. Now all three, Dick and the boy and Perry, were piling out of the car and shamelessly, though amiably, competing with one another. Once Dick located a cache of wine and whiskey bottles at the bottom of a ditch and was chagrined to learn that his discovery was valueless. They don't give no refund on liquor empties, the boy informed him. Even some of the beers ain't no good. I don't mess with them usually. Just stick with the surefire things. Dr. Pepper, Pepsi, Coke, White Rock, Knee High. Dick said, what's your name? Bill, the boy said. Well, Bill, you're a regular education. Nightfall came and forced the hunters to quit. That and lack of space, for they had amassed as many bottles as the car could contain. The trunk was filled. The back seat seemed a glittering dump heap. Unnoticed, unmentioned by even his grandson, the ailing old man was all but hidden under the shifting, dangerously chiming cargo. Dick said, be funny if we had a smash-up. A bunch of lights publicized the new motel, which proved to be, as the travelers neared it, an impressive compound consisting of bungalows, a garage, a restaurant, and a cocktail lounge. Taking charge, the boy said to Dick, pull in there. Maybe we can make a deal. Only let me talk. I've had the experience. Sometimes they try to cheat. Perry could not imagine anyone smart enough to cheat that kid, he said later. It didn't shame him a bit going in there with all those bottles. Me, I never could have. I'd have felt so ashamed. But the people at the motel were nice about it. They just laughed. Turned out the bottles were worth $12.60. The boy divided the money evenly, giving half to himself, the rest to his partners, and said, know what? I'm gonna blow me and Johnny to a good feed. Ain't you fellas hungry?
As always, Dick was. And after so much activity, even Perry felt starved. As he later told about it, we carted the old man into the restaurant and propped him up at a table. He looked exactly the same. Thanatoid. And he never said one word. But you should have seen him shovel it in. The kid ordered him pancakes. He said that was what Johnny liked best. I swear he ate something like 30 pancakes, with maybe 2 pounds of butter and a quart of syrup. The kid could put it down himself. Potato chips and ice cream, that was all he wanted, but he sure ate a lot of them. I wonder it didn't make him sick. During the dinner party, Dick, who had consulted a map, announced that Sweetwater was 100 or more miles west of the route he was driving, the route that would take him across New Mexico and Arizona to Nevada, to Las Vegas. Though this was true, it was clear to Perry that Dick simply wanted to rid himself of the boy and the old man. Dick's purpose was obvious to the boy, too, but he was polite and said, "Oh, don't you worry about us. Plenty of traffic must stop here. We'll get a ride." The boy walked with them to the car, leaving the old man to devour a fresh stack of pancakes. He shook hands with Dick and with Perry, wished them a happy new year, and waved them away into the dark. The evening of Wednesday, December 30th, was a memorable one in the household of Agent A.A. Dewey. Remembering it later, his wife said, "Alvin was singing in the bath, The Yellow Rose of Texas. The kids were watching TV, and I was setting the dining room table for a buffet. I'm from New Orleans. I love to cook and entertain, and my mother had just sent us a crate of avocados and black-eyed peas and, oh, a heap of real nice things. So I decided we are going to have a buffet, invite some friends over, the Murrays and Cliff and Dodie Hope. Alvin didn't want to, but I was determined. My goodness, the case could go on forever, and he hadn't taken hardly a minute off since it began. Well, I was setting the table, so when I heard the phone, I asked one of the boys to answer it. Paul. Paul said it was for Daddy, and I said, 'You tell them he's in the bath.' But Paul said he wondered if he ought to do that, because it was Mr. Sanford calling from Topeka, Alvin's boss. Alvin took the call with just a towel around him. Made me so mad. Dripping puddles everywhere. But when I went to get a mop, I saw something worse. That cat, that fool Pete, up on the kitchen table, gorging crab meat salad. My avocado stuffing. The next thing was, suddenly Alvin had hold of me. He was hugging me, and I said, 'Alvin Dewey, have you lost your mind? Fun's fun, but the man was wet as a pond. He was ruining my dress, and I was already dressed for company.' Of course, when I understood why he was hugging me, I hugged him right back. You can imagine what it meant to Alvin to know those men had been arrested. Out in Las Vegas. He said he had to leave for Las Vegas straight away, and I asked him hadn't he ought to put on some clothes first. And Alvin, he was so excited, he said, 'Gosh, honey, I guess I've spoiled your party.' I couldn't think of a happier way of having it spoiled. Not if this meant that maybe one day soon we'd be back living an ordinary life." Alvin laughed. It was just beautiful to hear him. I mean, the past 2 weeks had been the worst of all. Because the week before Christmas, those men turned up in Kansas City. Came and went without getting caught, and I never saw Alvin more depressed. Except once when young Alvin was in the hospital, had encephalitis, we thought we might lose him. But I don't want to talk about that. Anyway, I made coffee for him and took it to the bedroom where he was supposed to be getting dressed. But he wasn't. He was sitting on the edge of our bed holding his head, as if he had a headache. Hadn't put on even a sock. So I said, 'What do you want to do, get pneumonia?' And he looked at me and said, 'Marie, listen. It's got to be these guys. Has to. That's the only logical solution.' Alvin's funny. like the first time he ran for Finney County Sheriff. Election night, when practically every vote had been counted and it was plain as plain he'd won, he said, I could have strangled him, said over and over, well, we won't know till the last return. I told him, now, Alvin, don't start that. Of course they did it. He said, where's our proof? We can't prove either of them ever set foot inside the Clutter house. But that seemed to me exactly what he could prove. Footprints. Weren't footprints the one thing those animals left behind? Alvin said yes, and a big lot of good they are, unless those boys still happen to be wearing the boots that made them. Just footprints by themselves aren't worth a Dixie dollar. I said, all right, honey, drink your coffee and I'll help you pack. Sometimes you can't reason with Alvin. The way he kept on, he had me almost convinced Hickok and Smith were innocent, and if they weren't innocent, they would never confess, and if they didn't confess, they could never be convicted. The evidence was too circumstantial. What bothered him most, though, he was afraid that the story would leak, that the men would learn the truth before the KBI could question them. As it was, they thought they'd been picked up for parole violation, passing bad checks. And Alvin felt it was very important they keep thinking that. He said the name Clutter has to hit them like a hammer, a blow they never knew was coming. Paul. I'd sent him out to the wash line for some of Alvin's socks. Paul came back and stood around watching me pack. He wanted to know where Alvin was going. Alvin lifted him up in his arms. He said, can you keep a secret, Polly? Not that he needed to ask. Both boys know they mustn't talk about Alvin's work, the bits and pieces they hear around the house. So he said, Polly, you remember those two fellas we've been looking for? Well, now we know where they are, and Daddy's going to go get them and bring them here to Garden City. But Paul begged him, don't do that, Daddy. Don't bring them here. He was frightened. Any 9-year-old might have been. Alvin kissed him. He said, now that's okay, Polly. We won't let them hurt anybody. They're not going to hurt anybody ever again. At 5 that afternoon, some 20 minutes after the stolen Chevrolet rolled off the Nevada desert into Las Vegas, the long ride came to an end. But not before Perry had visited the Las Vegas post office, where he claimed a package addressed to himself in care of general delivery. The large cardboard box he had mailed from Mexico and had insured for $100, a sum exceeding to an impertinent extent the value of the contents, which were suntans and denim pants, worn shirts, underwear, and 2 pairs of steel-buckled boots. Waiting for Perry outside the post office, Dick was in excellent spirits. He had reached a decision that he was certain would eradicate his current difficulties and start him on a new road with a new rainbow in view. The decision involved impersonating an Air Force officer. It was a project that had long fascinated him, and Las Vegas was the ideal place to try it out. He'd already selected the officer's rank and name, the latter borrowed from a former acquaintance, the then warden of Kansas State Penitentiary, Tracy Hand. As Captain Tracy Hand, smartly clothed in a made-to-order uniform, Dick intended to crawl the strip, Las Vegas's street of never-closed casinos. Small time, big time, the Sands, the Stardust. He meant to hit them all, distributing en route a bundle of confetti. By writing worthless checks right around the clock, he expected to haul in $3,000, maybe $4,000 within a 24-hour period. That was half the plot. The second half was, goodbye, Perry. Dick was sick of him. His harmonica, his aches and ills, his superstitions, the weepy, womanly eyes, the nagging, whispering voice. Suspicious, self-righteous, spiteful, he was like a wife that must be got rid of. And there was but one way to do it. Say nothing. Just go. Absorbed in his plans, Dick did not notice a patrol car pass him. Slow down, reconnoiter.